whether you're violating the Clean Water Act or not, you shouldn't be confronted by armed federal marshals.
The EPA raids interior Alaska gold mines. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, September 5th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, ADAC residents endure dozens of aftershocks following last week's 7-magnitude quake.
I mean, as it's prolonged, the worry is this even normal for a geological event? Because it doesn't feel like it.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years.
A recent sweep by government agents looking for environmental violations at gold mines in the 40-mile region has angered locals and Alaska politicians. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the governor's office has ordered an investigation, and area placer miners are organizing to protest the Environmental Protection Agency lead action.
The enforcement trip took place during the week of August 19th. It was carried out by the federal and state Alaska Environmental Crimes Task Force, who used aircraft and ATVs to visit placer operations in the remote area off the Taylor Highway in the eastern interior. 40 Mile Miners Association President Sheldon Meyer says his operation was not visited, but he's upset by what happened at several other mine sites.
The EPA raided 14 mining camps for violations of the 404 Clean Water Act, and they had brought 7 fully armed federal marshals.
Meyer, who's been placer mining in the 40-mile country for over 20 years, says local miners have a history of battling with federal agencies over claims and access, but he's never heard of a similar enforcement action. The 40-mile is a national wild and scenic river. Meyer says water quality concerns at placer operations there involve turbidity and arsenic, and he acknowledges violations by some area miners, but says they don't warrant a heavy-handed response.
They supposedly did find some egregious violations, but, you know, contrary to that, whether you're violating the Clean Water Act or not, you shouldn't be confronted by armed federal marshals. I would think, you know, they could come and tell you. There's no reason for the whole intimidation. So, and we're hoping to get some, you know, sort of resolution to say, look, this is not acceptable.
Meyer says the 40 Mile Miners Association, which represents about 70 local miners, is organizing a meeting scheduled for September 14th in Chicken to bring together miners, legislators, and representatives of the state and federal government agencies to talk about what happened. Alaska's congressional delegation has already taken notice, and Alaska Governor Sean Parnell has ordered an investigation of the state and federal agencies involved. Governor's spokeswoman Sharon Lehow claims action was taken without the governor's knowledge and only last-minute notification of the Department of Environmental Conservation Commissioner and Alaska Attorney General. She says a special counsel is being appointed to look into the matter.
The governor expects a full report on how this could have transpired and why a state DEC investigator was involved. He's also deeply troubled with what appears to be a lack of coordination with the Alaska State Troopers and a lack of communication with top state officials.
The governor is also calling on EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy to review how the agency handles Clean Water Act investigations. Citing an ongoing investigation, EPA spokesman Mark McIntyre would only provide a prepared statement on what happened in the field. He says the investigation was focused on federal lands with a history of noncompliance and ongoing significant discharges. It describes interactions with miners as consensual and cordial, adding that violations were found, but no arrests were made. The enforcement team included representatives of the EPA, Bureau of Land Management, and the State Department of Environmental Conservation. Alaska State Trooper spokeswoman Megan Peters says troopers were not involved, except for loaning a BLM agent a four-wheeler. DEC Information Officer Ty Keltner describes his agency's role as minor.
We did send one compliance officer out there to look into state permitting and things like that. But this was primarily an EPA federal incident.
Keltner says the state has taken on a greater role in water permitting, but the EPA maintains jurisdiction and enforcement authority. The 40 Mile Miners Association's Meyer says locals have been working with the DEC to try to negotiate a compliance program that's better suited to small-scale placer miners. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Hundreds of aftershocks are rattling the Aleutian chain following a 7.0 earthquake near Adak on Friday. As KUCB's Ben Matheson reports, residents are ready for life to get back to normal, but it could be months before the quakes subside.
The largest aftershock so far was bigger than most earthquakes in the chain. On Tuesday night, a 6.2 quake rumbled past Atka and Adak. Nothing was damaged, and it didn't trigger a tsunami, and the same goes for the other earthquakes that have hit the chain in the past week, but they're starting to take their toll. Adak City Manager Leighton Lockett says his office is constantly swaying.
It feels like you're going in a circle, or that kind of roundish movement.
Adak residents have to dart in and out of their homes to evacuate during aftershocks. They're brief, but constant.
It's kind of got us thinking, wow, is there a sequence to this? Or is something really going on? I mean, it's prolonged, the worry is this even normal for a geological event? Because it doesn't feel like it.
According to Natasha Rupert, it is. Rupert is a seismologist with the Alaska Earthquake Information Center.
And this is expected for a magnitude 7 to produce hundreds and even thousands of aftershocks.
Many of these aftershocks register at magnitude 5 or 6. That's serious shaking. And if a big quake hits at the right spot, it could trigger a tsunami. Bill Dushkin is a village public safety officer in Atka. He's felt at least 5 aftershocks since Friday.
Everybody's kind of getting used to them now, kind of like desensitized to them a little.
Still, Dushkin says Atka's taking precautions. He stays in contact with the Alaska Tsunami Warning Center, and most residents are keeping their VHF radios turned up in case there's a call to evacuate. That heightened alert level will stay in place for the time being. Rupert, the seismologist, says it could be at least a few weeks before things calm down.
The frequency of the aftershocks will continue to go down, but it won't be back to background levels until a couple of months later.
And that's true for communities beyond Atka or Adak. The Aleutian chain is one big fault, which might explain why 2 earthquakes hit near Unalaska early Wednesday. They weren't aftershocks of the big 7.0 earthquake, but Rupert says they may be part of the larger seismic pattern that's rippling through the western Aleutians, and that means the entire chain could be in for a bumpy season. In Unalaska, I'm Ben Matheson.
It's official. A controversial tax cut on oil companies will be put to a vote. Division of Elections Director Gail Fanoumiai certified the referendum on the new tax law this Tuesday. In her letter to the repeal efforts organizers, Fanoumiai verified that the group Vote Yes, Repeal the Giveaway had met all of the legal requirements to get on the ballot. The division verified that more than 45,000 of the signatures they turned in came from registered voters. They needed 30,000 signatures to qualify. Jim Whitaker is one of the sponsors of the referendum. He's not surprised that the Division of Elections okayed the referendum, but he is happy.
I think all Alaskans should be pleased that we have a chance to make a decision individually about something that is going to affect the future of our state for a long time. And this is our shot. This is our chance to do what we think is right.
The law the referendum seeks to strike down has been a key priority of Governor Sean Parnell. It caps the tax rate on oil at 35%, with significant breaks for new oil production. At forecasted oil prices, the law is expected to cut taxes on North Slope producers by at least $3 billion over the next 5 years. Supporters of the new tax policy argue it will spur investment in the face of declining production. But those behind the repeal effort say the law will lower state revenue without any guarantee of more oil through the pipeline. If the referendum passes, Alaska would go back to a system where the tax rate goes up with the price of oil. The referendum is slated to appear on the August 19th primary ballot. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new twist on locally grown dahlia flowers near Hatcher Pass.
Lacinate cactus, semi-cactus, incurved cactus. And that's Edge of Joy over there, the purple one.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has studied regional population, household, and employment statistics to forecast future traffic and revenue models for the Kinnick Arm Crossing. The authority is updating this data and commissioning an independent peer review of the work that's been completed so far. The results are expected in fall 2013. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
The state's largest public employee union and the Parnell administration will enter into arbitration over the issue of office space. An arbitrator has been selected, but the time frame for the negotiations are still unknown. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more on the story.
Arbitration depends on the availability of the state, the union, and the person selected to settle the dispute. The state says that may not be until August 2014. Alaska State Employees Union Executive Director Jim Duncan says that's not acceptable.
Members have a right to have their issues heard in a timely manner, and a year from now is not timely. And meanwhile, during that period of time, we will have members who will continue to be negatively impacted by the issue that we are in arbitration about.
The union filed a class action grievance in July because it believes the state's office standards drastically changed the work environment. Duncan says the state failed to negotiate with the union prior to implementing the standards, which violates the collective bargaining agreement. Deputy Administration Commissioner Curtis Thayer says the state has had space standards for at least 33 years.
They've never bargained them with the union. Management has always had the right to establish the space and the desk and the working environment.
Duncan says putting more employees into a smaller number of floors poses safety and health concerns in regards to the number of fire exits and restrooms. The number of those isn't increasing. Privacy is also a concern.
We have members who deal with a lot of issues that are confidential in nature, protected issues under federal law. The clientele they serve needs to know that their conversations are being held in private.
The state's office standards include private telephone booths, conference rooms, and other features that Thayer believes improve the work environment.
We're giving them ergonomically correct furniture. We're giving them right to light. They're getting new break rooms and dishwashers and microwaves and coffee pots that they never had before. And the employees are thanking us for it.
Duncan says the state is painting a picture that employees are happy with the new office space.
That's entirely false. And I am getting emails constantly. We are getting many more members attending our worksite meetings than we've ever had on this topic. There is more interest in this. There's more opposition to this. There's more concern on this issue from our members than any other issue that we've been addressing in recent times.
Deputy Commissioner Thayer doesn't know what the union wants out of the arbitration. He says employees are already in the new cubicles.
We can't put them back into the old stuff. It's not here anymore. The break rooms are already triples of the size they used to be. We're not going to return the new refrigerator and the dishwasher to the local appliance store. So that's one of the things that I'm kind of trying to understand is what do they want?
Duncan says the union continues to ask the state for the same thing.
Before they proceed, you have to sit down and negotiate those changes with the union and get our involvement. That would mean that they wouldn't proceed until we've had an agreement. By delaying the arbitration until August of next year, it's working in their benefit. We're going to continue to install the cubicles, and it's going to continue to have a negative impact on our membership.
According to Thayer, the Division of Insurance on the 15th floor of the Robert Atwood Building in Anchorage is up next for a space renovation. He says the division asked for it. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Drilling for a geothermal test well began today north of Nome at the Pilgrim Hot Springs. The Alaska Center for Energy and Power estimates 2 megawatts of sustainable power can be generated from the site. If the estimates are true, Nome residents may soon see the benefits of tapping into the resource. KNOM's Lorelei Kanin has the story.
The only operating geothermal power plant in Alaska is located at the Chena Hot Springs. Landowners of the Pilgrim Hot Springs hope to join the field. Gwen Holdman, the director for the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, was the engineer and project manager for the plant at Chena. She's now coordinating the drilling of a test well at the Pilgrim Hot Springs, 60 miles north of Nome.
I always thought that this resource out here on the Seward Peninsula had potential, and I've just felt really fortunate to be part of it. So yeah, who knows? We might be able to see a second power plant here in Nome someday.
Drilling the 1,000 feet to bedrock is expected to take a few weeks, and ASEP will conduct about 10 days of testing after that. What they'll be looking for is the number of gallons that flow from the well per minute. Holdman says they estimate about 2 megawatts of sustainable power can be generated from the Pilgrim Hot Springs site.
You know, we think that that's a reasonable target. Could be a little bit more. It could also potentially be a little bit less. And that's really what this particular drilling program is really intended to figure out.
Holdman says the temperature of the geothermal source at the Pilgrim is hotter than the source at Chena Hot Springs at just under 200 degrees Fahrenheit. It's pretty close to boiling.
It's certainly capable of generating power. The question is it economic to export to serve Nome and potentially other places in the peninsula, or is it just something that could be developed for local use on site, which would be, you know, very possible as well.
In order to generate 2 megawatts of electricity and justify the building of a transmission line to Nome, 2,000 gallons of that close to boiling water would need to flow from the wellhead per minute.
That's a high flow rate. Of course, if we are able to draw up hotter fluids, then it's kind of proportional. You need less water if you have higher temperatures. But that's really, you know, that's kind of our estimate right now, 2 megawatts. We think that that's a realistic target, and that's what we're going to try to verify over the next few weeks.
Unadak, a coalition of regional organizations and village corporations, are the landowners of the Pilgrim Hot Springs. The Bering Straits Native Corporation is a part of that coalition, and the corporation's vice president of resources and external affairs, Matt Ganley, says a company called Patelco has expressed interest in building a power plant and the transmission line to Nome if indeed the 2 megawatts of electricity can be produced.
We see it as a real win-win for everybody involved. If the well can produce enough electricity for Nome, that's wonderful. If it can't, we still have access to a great geothermal resource that we didn't have before.
So if there's less than 2 megawatts of energy coming from the source, Ganley says there's still opportunity for agriculture and tourism.
Part of the process of testing this well is that we're going to actually construct a flow-through pond that will be able to be used after the fact for bathing and things like that.
So essentially, either way, the hot springs will have a much nicer complex for visitors to enjoy the benefits of the hot springs. Most of the funding for drilling of the test well this fall comes from the Department of Energy. However, Holdman says various local organizations have contributed. There's Unadak, the Nome Chamber of Commerce, the City of Nome, and the Bering Straits, White Mountain, and Sitnasauk Native Corporations.
It's just been fantastic to see everyone really pull together and get behind this program. And so hopefully at the end of the day, we'll at least understand whether this resource could be developed, and if so, in what way.
And what can be developed should be known in roughly 3 weeks. If the amount flowing out of the wellhead is adequate, federal tax credits would make the development of the power plant and that transmission line feasible. Reporting in Nome, I'm Lorelei Kinnean.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ERA. For more than 40 years, ERA Alaska's planes have carried the stories of Alaska. ERA Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. More at flyera.com. The Federal Subsistence Board is seeking ideas to improve the rural determination process. Only Alaska residents living in rural areas or communities are eligible to harvest fish and wildlife resources on federal public lands under federal subsistence regulations. The deadline to submit your ideas is November the 1st. For more information, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
September winds in Anchorage and South Central Alaska may increase going into the weekend, but National Weather Service forecaster Christian Cassell says they shouldn't reach the intensity or duration of last fall's big storm. However, the rain the region has been experiencing over the past month will get heavier late tonight. Cassell says the areas of most concern are Valdez and Cordova. He says rain will move in after midnight, but be especially heavy tomorrow afternoon.
The good news is that it looks to only be like a six-hour period of really intense rain, but it looks very intense. I mean, we could be talking in a six-hour period in the mountains above Valdez and Cordova, you know, 6 to 10 inches. And in Valdez and Cordova itself, you know, maybe 3 to 4 inches in 6 hours. That's pretty intense rainfall rates.
Cassell says that rain will run off into swollen creeks and rivers, increasing the potential for floods. Numerous coal development projects are slated for lands in the Matanuska Valley that are owned by the Alaska Mental Health Trust. Some Anchorage and Valley residents are concerned about mercury poisoning linked to coal development, and on Wednesday, they aired their concerns before the Board of Directors of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
Pam Miller, who heads Alaska Community Action on Toxics, or ACAT, says that a recent report indicates that mercury found in Pacific Ocean fish has a fingerprint from coal plants in Asia. Miller says that proposed Alaska coal development projects aim at shipping the coal produced to Asian markets. Many of the proposed coal development projects are on land owned by the Alaska Mental Health Trust. On Wednesday, Miller and a group of protesters staged a demonstration at the Alaska Mental Health Trust building. Later, Miller testified before a Trust Authority board meeting.
The health hazards of mercury are well known to you. Exposure causes developmental disorders in children, including learning disabilities, impairment of mental abilities, memory, and motor functions. Please divest from coal. Its destructive cycle is antithetical to your mission.
A number of Alaskans who belong to the group Mothers Against Mercury gave comments similar to Miller's. Jamie Duhamel is an anti-coal activist living in Sutton near three proposed coal mines.
I understand your fiduciary responsibility to this board, and I understand your social responsibility to the people of Alaska. What I continue to be confused about is where you stand on your moral responsibility to the people who will be directly affected by an industry, a coal mining extraction and burning industry, that is located right next to our homes.
The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority is a state corporation that administers Alaska Mental Health Trust funds on behalf of trust beneficiaries. Trust resources are used to fund mental health and drug and alcohol recovery programs throughout the state. Jeff Jesse, Chief Executive Officer of the Mental Health Trust Authority, says the trust only owns the subsurface under some of the trust lands, and that limits the trust's options on use of the land.
We understand that they're concerned about the health impacts of mining, which is why the trustees are committed that both the trust and our licensees will comply with all of the permitting and environmental requirements that are in place to ensure that this type of development is done in a environmentally safe and responsible way.
Jeff Jesse says that coal development so far has not added a great deal to the trust's revenues, although he could not say how much. Although trust lands are leased for coal exploration and development, coal mining permits are approved by the State Division of Mining, Land and Water Coal Regulatory Program. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The local food market in Alaska is well established, but there's a quieter movement gaining momentum in Alaska agriculture. Flowers. Peonies make up the largest share of flower farming in the state, and they're exported around the world. And at Anchorage Farmers Markets, zinnias, sunflowers, and dahlias have moved in alongside the kale and potatoes. Anchorage Daily News columnist Julia O'Malley visited a dahlia farmer in Palmer and has this story.
Rob Wells talks about his dahlias the way some people talk about ships or impressive storms, with a tone of reverence.
Dahlias express themselves in so many different ways.
How do you mean?
Size, form, shape.
There are more than 500 plants at his Palmer farm, with a psychedelic array of blooms, from creamsicle orange to merlot to luminous white. Some flowers are dinner plate size, others are perfectly round, the size of a tennis ball.
All different forms. Decorative, formal decorative, ball, miniature, lacinate, cactus, semi-cactus, incurved cactus. And that's Edge of Joy over there, the purple one.
Wells has been farming on his property for more than 30 years. He's had a turn in local politics, state government, and as a partner in the embattled Matanuska Creamery. Dahlias have been his biggest crop since 2010. He's part of a commercial flower growing trend that's taken hold across the state. He sells flowers to local customers, and he also sells the tubers, kind of like bulbs, to customers around the world on the internet. He kneels in his field and digs up a dahlia plant to show me the tubers.
You can see the root. And unlike a potato, which has eyes all over, the eyes on a dahlia are only up here by the neck.
Wells started selling local food in the late 70s with a blueberry jam table on 3rd Avenue. After that, he and a handful of other vendors sold local vegetables downtown. There was a market for what he was selling, but it wasn't huge. All that has changed. He thinks young shoppers are driving the interest, but says the culture around food is changing too.
It's caught on, and people understand why it's beneficial, because it's more nutritious, it's fresher, and if you have a bad product, you go back and you go, I want my money back. And it's not like going into a big store. I go, okay, here's your money.
Wells says long summer days in Alaska make dahlias more vibrant here, but the weather can be challenging. He heats his greenhouse with propane to keep selling blooms into October, and that cuts into his profits. Extreme winds and snow are hard on his greenhouses.
Like all farming, it's a nice business, but the money.
Why do it, then?
I like the commute. I love my flowers. It's my passion.
He walks through rows of dahlias in his greenhouse and stops next to a flower the size of a saucer with lavender-tipped petals and a white center.
Oh, my goodness.
What kind of dahlia is that?
They all have names. This is Vanquisha.
In a few weeks, Wells will pull up his plants for winter. He stores the tubers in a neighbor's root cellar. He says they'll nap until they're ready to sprout again next spring. In Anchorage, I'm Julia O'Malley.
This story is part of a collaboration between the Anchorage Daily News and APRN. You can find a link to a slideshow of Rob Wells' Dahlia Farm at alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ben Matheson in Unalaska, Lisa Fu in Juneau, Lorelei Kanin in Nome, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Julia O'Malley in Palmer. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Salmon Project. In Alaska, salmon are food, annual traditions, and a source of jobs, businesses, and community. Information on caring for salmon habitat or your weekend catch, plus salmon love stories at salmonlove.com.
And by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Parents, encourage your kids to participate in the Healthy Futures Challenge at their school. It's free and a lot of fun. All your kids need to do is be active each week and keep a log of their physical activities. They'll feel great and get cool prizes, too. Go to playeveryday.alaska.gov to find out if your child's elementary school is participating. And parents, why not get out and play every day with your kids? It's great for the whole family. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.